We are talking today with Chalmers Johnson. He is author of the new book, The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. Chalmers, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
If we could start out, could you tell us about what the motivation was for writing The Sorrows of Empire?
Well, above all, it is to lay out before the American public, I think, a vast amount of data in a readable, non-academic format that I'm sure they don't have, concerning, above all, the American base world, the empire of 725 military bases in other people's countries. That number is the DOD's, the Department of Defense's number. The actual number is probably 300 larger once you include all the espionage bases, the disguised bases, the ones they simply don't want to acknowledge, the ones they're too embarrassed to acknowledge. I believe this constitutes an empire of a new sort, that today the military base has become the equivalent of what used to be the colony. And we've got them from Greenland to Latin America, from Japan to Australia. And they're on 130 different countries, a 500,000 people, 250,000 uniformed troops, another quarter of a million dependents, spies, technicians spread around the world. They're part of a now modern professional military. It has not been an obligation of citizenship since 1973 to serve in the armed forces to defend the country. Service in the armed forces today is a career choice, often made by people facing various dead ends of our society. African Americans are twice as well represented in the Army as they are within the society. I thought when PSC Jessica Lynch was wounded near Nasiriyah, she was asked, why did you join the Army? She said, I couldn't get a job at Walmart in Palestine, West Virginia. I joined the Army to get out of Palestine, West Virginia. At the same time, she did not expect to be shot at. It's almost one of the terms of reference these days, that you won't get shot at. It's a route of social mobility, a way to improve yourself, to prepare to take the police exam or something like that. You don't have to have any college credits if you've been in the Army to take police exams in big cities. Things like that. It's not a terribly unpleasant life. I'm convinced that the troops of the 3rd Marine Division sitting on Okinawa in the last half century they live better there than they would in a small stateside town like Oceanside, California, next door to Camp Pendleton. They remind me of the Soviet troops in East Germany when the wall came down. They didn't want to go home. And they didn't for 5 years. 234 military golf courses around the world, the Armed Forces Ski Center at Garmisch in the Bavarian Alps, 71 luxury Lear jets to carry admirals and generals to these places. It's state socialism, cradle to grave, housing, medical care, education, not much pay, but a nice pension, and the legionnaires like it. And that's what I'm trying to display here, something that I think Americans know nothing about, this semi-secret, enclosed, self-regarding base empire. These bases set up around the world, usually to look like little small American Bible Belt towns. They've all got a Burger King. There's a Burger King at Baghdad International Airport right now. It's not all stateside, though. I mean, for example, there's a lot of women in the armed forces these days and very high rate of sexual assaults. You can't get an abortion in a military hospital abroad. You're just on your own. You'd have to go on the open market in Baghdad if you woke up and found yourself pregnant, which is not a very pleasant prospect. But the devil here is in the details, and I'm trying to offer a lot of details about the professional army, about the unbelievable expense of these bases. They do not actually produce anything. They merely support our empire. We have now committed ourselves to the military domination of the globe, and that's a expensive proposition, also one that is virtually guaranteeing a world of enemies against us. I mean, what I don't think any American appreciates is that though we are often talk about the influence of our music, of our movies, or things of this sort, most foreigners encountering Americans encounter 18 to 24-year-old young males, usually in the special forces, uniformed, very strongly giving the impression that the United States wishes to rule the world through military force rather than through some soft power or influence or something of that sort. The 38 military bases in Okinawa, Japan's poorest, southernmost prefecture, have been a constant source of irritation. The most famous incident was September 4th, 1995, when two Marines and a sailor abducted, beat, and raped a 12-year-old girl. It produced the largest demonstrations against the United States since the Japanese-American Security Treaty was signed. Our military tried to pretend at the time that this was a unique, tragic incident, just three bad apples. Actually, the rate of sexually violent crimes leading to court-martial in Okinawa is about two per month, averages out at two per month, and has been for 50 years. So we ask an awful lot of other people around the world to tolerate things that I guarantee you the United States would not tolerate in its own country, in terms not just of sex crimes, but noise pollution, environmental pollution, bar brawls, prostitution, things like this. It's a, I believe, my book is alarmist, but I am trying to ring an alarm.
In your book, you say imperialism is hard to define, but easy to recognize. Can you give us a definition of imperialism?
Imperialism is the attempt to dominate others. There's any number of words for it, hegemony, colonialism, things of this sort. But all it basically means is the acquisition of foreign territory. Remember, these bases are exclusively American bases. They're always governed by status of forces agreements, where we try to protect our troops from ever being tried in a domestic court for crimes they commit and things of this sort. The inescapable accompaniment of imperialism is militarism, by which I do not mean the defense of the country. I mean large standing armies with vested interests in their own life, vested interests in the military-industrial complex, in the people that supply them, companies like Kellogg Brown & Root, subsidiary of Dick Cheney's Halliburton Company. I want to remind your readers of probably the two most famous generals who ever served as presidents. George Washington, in his farewell address, warned us in unequivocal terms about the dangers of standing armies, that it led to a distortion of our Constitution in favor of the imperial presidency and the weakening of the Congress and the courts. Equally famously, Dwight Eisenhower, in his farewell address in 1961, invented the phrase military-industrial complex. He actually, we know from his memoirs, intended to say military-industrial-congressional complex, but was warned off that that was not a wise direction for him to go. But he was positively strident about one ought to go back and read the whole statement by a very conservative man, that we are risking the Republic in allowing this kind of power to arise. If nothing more, I remind you, 40% of the defense budget is secret. All of the secret intelligence agencies' budgets are secret. This means that even if you did happen to have an honest Congress, which we don't, but if you did, they couldn't do oversight anyway. They simply don't have the elementary information to watch these organizations. I think what this combination of imperial overstretch in over 700 bases around the world, combined with the tremendous vested interests in perpetuating it, add that the correct word for it is empire, and the correct word for its Siamese twin is militarism.
Can you give us a picture of when militarism started to become an integral part of U.S. policy?
It's not that new. It probably began during World War II, when much of the base empire was created. We always acquire bases in one of our wars. We never give them up after the wars are over. That is, the bases in Okinawa have been there since the Battle of Okinawa in the spring of 1945, the last bloodiest battle of World War II. And they've been hated every day since we've been there. For the first 20 years until 1972, Okinawa was a Pentagon directly ruled colony, ruled by an Army lieutenant general. I think militarism, though, became most obvious as a result of various developments. One, the abandonment of conscription in 1973 in favor of a volunteer army. This begins to produce a truly professionalized corps that sees itself separately from civilian enterprises. These are not citizen soldiers called to defend the country. These are, as I say, people who've made a choice to live and work in the military and expect to be compensated and honored for doing that. I think equally important, it's one of the main themes in my book, I believe the United States made a disastrous error, disastrous analysis of the world in 1991 at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union. We concluded, many of our conservative, so-called neoconservative defense intellectuals that dominate the Pentagon today, they concluded that this meant we had won the Cold War. I don't think we had won the Cold War. I believe that we didn't lose it as badly as they did, because we were always richer than they were. But many of the same things that brought down the Soviet Union are now afflicting our society quite severely, and I could go into that if you want to. Having concluded that we won the Cold War, we then concluded that we were a new Rome, that we were beyond good and evil, that we were a colossus athwart the world, that we no longer needed friends, that we had such overwhelming military power, we could enforce our will anywhere and at any time. This then began to lead to the expansion of the military, to enormously ambitious projects like putting weapons in outer space, things of this sort, the ballistic missile defense, the growing encroachment of the Pentagon on other branches of the government. Today, in terms of the federal budget spent on international affairs, 93% is spent by the Pentagon, 7% by the State Department. It's sort of a reflection of again, what the rest of the world inevitably encounters when they think of the United States, and it's not just a Hollywood movie or a good rock record. The militarism continues to advance apace. It does remind me of the last years of the Roman Republic, when Rome, as a country enjoying very considerable civil rights for its citizens, inadvertently, almost unconsciously, acquired an empire around the Mediterranean, and then discovered that the inescapable consequence of that was a standing military, which slowly led to the rise of military populism, of conservative figures who broke away from their natural class affiliations and began to popularize the issues of the military, the most famous, of course, being Julius Caesar. This ultimately led, in 27 BC, to the Roman Senate simply throwing in the towel and turning over power to a military dictator, Octavian, who then became the god Augustus Caesar, and it was a military dictatorship. We call that the Roman Empire, but it was certainly the end of those elements of Roman society that are so clearly written into our own constitution, separation of powers, term limits. You'll recall that James Madison and Jay and people like that, the defending the Constitution in the Federalist Papers, always signed their names Publius. Who was Publius? He was the first Roman consul, Publius Agricola. I'm saying something similar to what I believe is being said daily by a man I admire a great deal, that's Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia, who is making these impassioned speeches to empty Senate chambers about the threat to the Constitution today. I believe it is in, or that is to say, you've got an argument if you want to argue that the Constitution of 1787, the structure of government outlined there, actually bears any resemblance at all to the government in Washington, D.C. at the present time.
Going along with your the parallel with the Roman Empire, yeah. Where do you see us currently in terms of the fall of that empire?
We may have already crossed the Rubicon. That's the problem. It may be irreversible. It is nowhere written that the American Republic goes on forever. In my lifetime, I've had personal knowledge, if not personal experience, of the decline and fall of the Nazi Thousand-Year Reich. It lasted 12 years, of the British Empire, the French Empire, the Dutch Empire, the Soviet Empire. There's no reason to believe that the United States is immune to these same pressures, and that's what I'm trying to point out. I believe the only thing that could reverse it now would be a remarkable renaissance of the American public, as Senator Byrd believes is possible. I'm not sure he's right, as they begin to realize how betrayed they have been in their government, to rise up, reclaim the Constitution, reinvigorate the Congress as a genuine body of elected representatives of the people. I mean, I offer you just one example of what I'm getting at. James Madison, easily the most important author of our Constitution, wrote in the Federalist Papers the single most important clause in it was the one restricting the right to go to war to the elected representatives of the people. He said unequivocally it should never, under any circumstances, should that power be given to a single man. The responsibility is too great. Well, in October of 2002, with more or less no debate whatsoever, both houses of our Congress voted to give that power to a single man on his say-so, using nuclear weapons if he wants to, and the following year in March, he used that power to invade a sovereign country, Iraq, without any apparent international legitimacy in what he was doing, and is now all of a sudden found himself bogged down in a place where he can probably neither stay nor leave. It is a real disaster. But again, is to say, if this is the most important article in the Constitution, it's in trouble. Articles 4 and 6 of the Bill of Rights, habeas corpus and the right to be secure in your home, are today dead letters. That is, the president has invented a new category on his own say-so, so-called bad guy. If he declares you, even though you're a native-born citizen, to be a bad guy, you can be locked up in a naval prison in Charleston, South Carolina, and they throw the key away. We're about to find out in a few months whether the Supreme Court that appointed this president is now prepared to use its powers to review whether or not he has the ability to do these things. But as it stands right now, he has it, and his attorney general claims it. So, the question is, are we over the edge? Have we gone too far? It's one of the things that worries me most. I believe that George Bush could probably be defeated in an election, or he's in the process of discrediting himself, regardless of what the Democratic Party does. But I'm not myself convinced that whoever might replace him could stand up to the enormous vested interests of the Pentagon, the secret intelligence agencies, the military-industrial complex. I say this if for no other reason. Mikhail Gorbachev attempted to reform the Soviet system. That is, in 1989, he began by deciding that it served the interests of Russia to have more friendly relations with France and Germany than with the sort of rundown satellites, Romania and Bulgaria and places like that in East Europe, and he let them go. He was then, however, subsequently stopped cold by vested interests in the Cold War system in the Soviet Union, that they undercut everything he tried to do. Do we have such vested interests in this country? I think to ask the question is to answer it. That is, politically well-connected capitalists today are making enormous returns off of the supply of weapons, of the world of private military companies. I guarantee you, for your listeners who are veterans of World War II, or as I am, of Korea or of Vietnam, service in the armed forces today you wouldn't recognize. You don't do KP any longer. You don't clean the latrines. You don't do any of those duties. They're all supplied for you by private military companies that make enormous amounts of money doing this. Of the $87 billion just recently appropriated by Congress for Iraq, fully a third of it is going to companies like Kellogg Brown and Root to feed the troops in Iraq, try to make them as comfortable as possible. We hope, remember it's a volunteer army, we hope they'll re-enlist. Now, we're going to find out in a few months, since they didn't enlist with the understanding they were going to get shot at, now that 530 of them are killed casualties in Iraq, will they re-enlist? This may be one of the main ultimate limits on our empire, that the public just decides they don't want any part of it, because if this is a route of social mobility, there must be a better one than that. It's just too dangerous. We will see that within 2 months, 40% of the troops in Iraq will be National Guard or reservists. They didn't expect to be serving in Baghdad or Nasiriyah or these kinds of bases in central Iraq today. I don't know whether we've gone too far. I mean, maybe just one slightly optimistic note. A year ago, February 2003, 10 million people around the world, in every democracy on earth, every genuine democracy, demonstrated in the streets against the forthcoming war in Iraq. This was a movement that actually began here in Seattle in November of 1999 in the struggle against the World Trade Organization and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. But these people, they haven't gone away. It was the biggest demonstrations in British history, 2 million in London, 400,000 in New York, 1 million in Berlin and Madrid and Rome. This, I believe, the rise of a pro-democracy, anti-war movement, and again, as I say, every democracy on earth, regardless of what their leaders, whether they listen to the people or not, constitutes almost a new superpower that has emerged to thwart American ambitions. They just finished their meeting in Bombay, the World Social Forum, in which Arundhati Roy gave this brilliant speech. If your listeners haven't seen it, you ought to read it. It's in the Nation magazine, called Do the Turkeys Enjoy Thanksgiving? She amazes me. She says things that no one else says, and the moment she said them, they become common knowledge. But she ends her talk by saying she's tired of demonstrating. She wants a global boycott against the United States now in every possible way. So that at the same time, there's a lot of these people out there, but will they make a difference? Back 40 years ago, when Adlai Stevenson was running for president, somebody stood up in one of his rallies and said, Mr. Stevenson, every intellectual in the country is behind you. And he said, that's great, but what I need is a majority. And we don't know whether we have one.
Can you go into some more detail on what the industries are that profit from our military spending?
Lockheed Martin is the world's largest arms producer. Their profits were up in the double-digit range, a 30% range last year. But it's the arms industry above all, Boeing, Raytheon, McDonnell, Grumman, and Northrop, that are profiting from building airplanes that really are inappropriate for the world we live in. It's one of the things that we probably ought to talk about is how inappropriate it has been to use our extremely high-tech military in an alleged war against terrorism, which has actually had the effect of exacerbating the problem rather than in any way coming to grips with it, or certainly of solving it. That Al-Qaeda, would just offer one measure, between 1993 and 2001, the attacks of 9/11, Al-Qaeda had carried out 5 major bombings globally. That's in 8 years. Since that time, in 2 years, they've carried out 17. That's including the big suicide attack in Istanbul recently against the HSBC Bank and the British consulate. We're losing the war with terrorism. There's no question about it that we have played directly into the strategy of terrorism by an inappropriate, overly militarized response. I mean, the only way to deal with terrorism is to try and separate the activists from their passive supporters and cause the passive supporters then to reveal who these activists are so that they can be arrested. The only way to do that is to be responsive to the legitimate grievances of the passive supporters and alter your policies in such a way that they are responsive. I think one of the things I am most critical of the current administration is its simply blatant refusal to continue the policies of the previous administration, or for that matter of all previous administrations, including the president's father's administration, of seeking a just and lasting, mutually equitable relationship between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The fact that we have not done this, that we have pursued Ariel Sharon's policies almost without question, means that we are today distrusted in every Islamic country on earth. And simultaneously, one of the things that worries me, we have greatly increased the long-term dangers to the State of Israel. That is, that it has been revealed almost daily that these imperialist enclaves of the Israelis in Palestinian territories are a cancer that ultimately could destroy Israeli society if they perpetuate what they're doing. This has been a dismal failure, in my opinion.
And in fact, even in Iraq, I understand that the U.S. was using Israeli military tactics, and the response has been suicide bombings.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that is, we simply have not learned the lessons of history that terrorism, that is, the attack on the innocent in order to draw attention to the sins of the invulnerable, that they would obviously prefer to attack directly their enemies. I mean, in the case of the attack on the Pentagon, that was not terrorism. That was attack on a legitimate target in a war by people who felt they had been badly betrayed by the United States. So that this pursuit of, in my opinion, misguided Israeli foreign policy is going to come back to haunt us. It's going to produce blowback, as I once used in the title of a previous book on this subject.
Can you talk more about the forces that are shaping our militarism here in the U.S.? Since profit is so integrated into that, how do we turn that off?
Well, ultimately, the only way to do it is to retake control of Congress and cut off the money to the Pentagon, to the secret intelligence agencies. Is one of the things I'm most critical of the Democratic Party for right now, even though Howard Dean did, in my opinion, accurately raise the Constitution as an issue early in his campaign. None of them have put forward an alternative vision of what we need, what should we be spending on the defense of the country, what other forms of foreign policy should we be engaged in. We pioneered foreign aid. Today we hardly pay any attention to it at all. We pioneered things like the Fulbright program to bring foreign scholars to our universities. Today, they're scared to come here because of our immigration controls put on by the Patriot Act. I mean, that is, people in Taiwan today thinking of going abroad to get a medical degree are by choice now going to Beijing. They speak Chinese. It's easier to get in there. They've got good schools. Why mess around with the extremely complex and insulting visa requirements of the United States? All of these things, I think, ought to be on the table, ought to be the subject of a much more serious critique than we're actually getting. Militarism is being spread by this uncritical acceptance of the military as if it were a citizen army in the sense of World War II. It's not that at all. It is highly secretive. The American public has not had, the first article of the Constitution guarantees the people an annual report on how their funds have actually been spent. In the name of secrecy, that has not been true since the Manhattan Project during World War II. And this secrecy is not really protecting the country. It's protecting the vested interests of uniformed officers and of the people that work for them. I mean, in the $10 billion just appropriated for ballistic missile research, it's not even appropriated. It's simply a large amount of money is given to the Missile Defense Command in the Pentagon and to the prime contractors, and they're told to, among themselves, decide how to spend it. You just figure it out how they want to spend it. Well, do you think there is some waste and malfeasance in this? To ask the question is to answer it. Of course there is, when it's that profitable and that secret. So that it grows apace. The military is also, or the military industrial complex is also sophisticated in building the B-2 bomber. They put a piece of it in as many states as they possibly can. The two mother hens of Military Facility Subcommittee of the Armed Services Committee are Senator Dianne Feinstein of California and Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas. They would do anything in their power to prevent the closing of another military base. Your two senators here in Washington turn into fascist hyenas when anybody talks about cutting Boeing's military budget. This is done certainly with malice aforethought. They know what they're doing to make sure that they're not presented with any kind of political united front. Therefore, the path of reform is so difficult, I would be more likely, rather than Senator Byrd, differing from Senator Byrd, to say I think the outcome in the United States would look much more like what happened in the Soviet Union than a fully successful reform in the sense of a reestablishment of the republic in the way it was intended to function, particularly with genuine separation of powers and genuine oversight by elected representatives of the people of what the executive branch is doing.
You had talked about the comparison between our current situation and the fall of Rome. You had also mentioned earlier about the Soviet Union and that it was really the economics which had crushed them as opposed to...
Well, I think there are three things that brought down the Soviet Union, and it's always worth talking about this because in the mid-1980s, not a soul in America, least of all the Central Intelligence Agency, was pointing out that we were overestimating the size of the Soviet economy by 50% for the sake of the Reagan administration. I mean, that is to say, the current overestimates on weapons of mass destruction are nothing new. Our intelligence estimates are really not as good as Harper's Magazine. In fact, interestingly enough, we now know that a lieutenant colonel, former professor at the National Defense University, prepared a net assessment on what's likely to happen in Iraq after our invasion. He predicted the chaos down to a T in great detail. But the amazing thing about this report, which came out before the invasion, was that everything in it was Googled off the Internet. He didn't use a single classified source. He just simply went to people who actually know something about Iraq rather than pals of Ahmad Chalabi or somebody else who got the ear of a ill-informed but enthusiastic young bureaucrat in Washington. But in the case of the Soviet Union, three things brought them down, and none of them were caused by the United States. That is, we know with a precision now, they ignored Reagan's Star Wars. They realized it would be quite easy, and it is even to this day, to defeat a missile defense by simply overwhelming it with targets, if nothing more. They were brought down by ideological rigidity in their economic institutions, making them much less efficient than they had been. Do we have that in this country? Well, that's Enron. That's Martha Stewart. That's pilfered pension funds. That's distrust of the mutual fund industry, scandals in the New York Stock Exchange. We're in considerable trouble in that area. Second, imperial overstretch. The feeling that is that they were pushed too far, feeling they had to meet the United States everywhere on every issue at every time. And that's what I'm talking about, imperial overstretch. 725 military bases, most of them left over from World War II, the Korean War, the first war with Iraq, and just our imperial ambitions. These are too many. We don't need them. They're a source of grievance against us by any number of people around the world. That is, I mean, I mentioned to you probably the most truly disgusting regime created by either side in the Cold War were the Greek colonels between 1967 and 1974. We put them in power. Our CIA put them in power. I mention this simply to say those of you who are thinking of going to the Olympics this summer that are returning to Greece, you should remember that Greece and South Korea are probably today among the most anti-American democracies on earth. They remember what the embrace of the United States did. The South Koreans, because of 101 military bases in a very small country, and with our troops being given extraordinary privileges so that they commit crimes and they're simply not tried in Korean courts. That is things that I say would produce the most extraordinary outrage in America if you'd had a division of Turkish troops based in downtown San Diego, my hometown, for the last 50 years. I guarantee you that fathers and grandfathers would say to their sons on Saturday night, go out and kill a Turk, restore our honor. And that's exactly what happened to the Russians in Afghanistan, what's happening to us today in Afghanistan and in Iraq. That is, the Iraqis are now, with the capture of Saddam Hussein, a young Iraqi no longer feels that he's a stooge for the old regime. He is now just a representative of the self-respect of his own people in the face of easily identifiable foreign invaders who are there presumptively to steal their resources, reflecting the fact that virtually every high executive in the American government today is a former petroleum company executive. I mean, Condoleezza Rice was a member of the board of Chevron until the day she entered the government. They even had a super tanker named after her, the Condoleezza Rice, which when she went into the government, they changed the name. As a former naval person, I regard it as bad luck to change the name of a ship, but at least give her credit, it was a double-hulled tanker. I mean, no Exxon Valdez for the Condoleezza Rice, but that it's no question one of our motives in this administration has been the military petroleum complex and the attempt to control the world through petroleum and also to continue to feed our exorbitant tastes for fossil fuels, our refusal to conserve in any way or to produce fuel-efficient automobiles. We have the technology to eliminate entirely our dependence on Persian Gulf oil. But in the wake of 9/11, the symbol of the United States became a young man speeding down the freeway in a Chevrolet Suburban, about 10, 11 miles a gallon, with an American flag attached to his antenna. The sales of Chevrolet Suburbans doubled after 9/11. They're the device of choice today, a thing that can carry 10 people, but usually with just one man in it going home in the evening on the freeways. all of these things, I think, add up to a picture that is, I hope I'm making the case that it's very disturbing and requires the attention of citizens. That's what I'm trying to do, is to mobilize the inattentive, to give them some information that I know they're not getting from news media that are all owned by entertainment conglomerates and simply are not reporting or even living up to what the First Amendment established freedom of the press for, so that journalists would be protected and virtually licensed to challenge the pretensions of high government officials living behind the walls of secrecy to try and expose what they're doing. The American public is very poorly informed. And as I say, it is possible that it is already too late, that there's really nothing else to do now but to start thinking about your escape route. My wife says to me, you must not continue to end your talks by saying to people, well, if you've got a little money ahead, a condo in Vancouver might not be the dumbest investment you ever made. But I'm sorry to say there is some truth to that.
Yeah, I visited South Korea last summer and was surprised by a number of things, the number of U.S. bases there, the dislike for the U.S. there, and I had not been fully aware of the U.S. role in the Korean War there, that it had been quite different from what I'd been taught in school.
Yes, no question about it. I mean, that is, the Korean War was a Korean Civil War, which we chose to treat as a skirmish in the Cold War. The people in the North have always had greater self-respect than our allies, because in their history they fought against Japanese colonialism that had dominated Korea from 1910 until 1945. The people in the South on our side were the ones who had collaborated with the Japanese, leaving them always open to the charge of nationalist betrayal. The North Koreans were considerably richer than the South for a long period of time. Over time, this slowly changed. South Korea is today twice as large as North Korea and 25 times richer. I guarantee you they could easily provide their own defense. They do not need the Americans to do that. And the amazing thing is how they've become much more sympathetic to the North Koreans today in the face of their designation as a member of the Axis of Evil and the apparent intent on the part of the American government to bring about regime change in the North through military force. That North Korea is a poster child today for much of the Third World. They look at what's happened since 9/11 and they say what was wrong with Saddam Hussein was that he really didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. If he'd really had them, the Americans would have taken him a lot more seriously and more cautiously and would not have invaded, just as in the case of the North, where they do actually have them. This is producing rethinking, I believe, in every Third World country. If the American imperial juggernaut comes after us, the only way to stop them is to have nuclear weapons. It's probably produced a greater impulse toward nuclear proliferation than anything that's been done. I'm reasonably certain that Lula da Silva, the president of Brazil, Brazil had a reasonably well-developed program toward nuclear weapons at one time, and they abandoned it when we induced them to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Today, I would be certain that President da Silva must have said to his advisors at some point, out of earshot of the American ambassador, if they declared us an axis of something or other and came after us, how long would it take to revive it? That's apparently the only thing that will stop these people. And as I say, it's being said everywhere. In the case of Korea, it is the long-standing grievances of too many Americans in their midst for too long, with, whole towns around air bases like Kunsan given over to prostitution. The U.S. military and the Korean government agrees to do this in order to protect self-respecting Korean women. It's a scandal, there have been books written about it. It's not something that I've just discovered or invented, and lots of them in Korean. The incident that set off these great anti-American demonstrations in Seoul were the killing of two 13-year-old girls walking on a mountain road, village road, north of Seoul, where they were crushed to death by a 60-ton American tracked military vehicle. It was virtually reported only as a filler at the end of the columns in American newspapers. For months, you had pictures spread over every Korean newspaper, and all of them are conservative, of what a body looks like after it's been crushed by a 60-ton vehicle. The Koreans demanded that the two sergeants responsible be turned over to them for trial in Korean courts. This occurred in Korea on Korean highway. It was not even clear that they were on active duty. The Americans refused to turn them over, conducted the trial themselves. It was fake. That is to say, their commanding officer was not even called to testify, even though he was in Korea at the time, about their qualifications and numerous things of this sort. It just produced outrage. The Koreans could not help but think, we are a satellite of the American legions, and that they're, we're just lucky that in this case they did anything at all with these two sergeants. In the old days, they'd have simply put them on an airplane and flown them out of the country before we could have gotten a hold of them, just like the endless sexually violent crimes in Okinawa. And so I'm not surprised that when you were in Korea, you saw signs in English on Seoul coffee shops and cafes that said, "No Americans, please." It's now ubiquitous. Moreover, the Eighth Army has, you know, put out the word to its troops, when you leave the base, they call it the buddy system, go with a couple of your pals. Koreans are, young Korean men are quite physical, and if you're found alone with a close-cut haircut and shine shoes, walking in the wrong parts of Seoul, they'll just beat the absolute hell out of you. That my students going to study at, say, Yonsei University, write back to me, if they're young men, to say, the first thing you must do if you're an American studying in this country, grow a ponytail. Look like a hipster. Do not look like you're in the 2nd Infantry Division. That's to send the wrong and foolish message in Korean society today.
You stated earlier that our rise of militarism basically started after World War II. How much have things increased with the current administration that we have now?
Oh, I think no question that, as I say, this disastrous conclusion after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that we were now a new Rome, that we were a power into our own right, that we didn't need friends. That line in the Declaration of Independence about the good respect of mankind, we no longer cared about the decent respect of mankind. This set up people like Paul Wolfowitz in the Bush senior administration, Cheney, Rumsfeld, characters like that, organized when they were out of power in something called the Project for a New American Century, whose basic doctrine was, they called it Pax Americana, the military domination of the world by the United States of every country, enemy or ally, to ensure that no country could begin to develop the force that could ever be used to check us. This includes up to and including, starting this year, putting weapons in outer space from which we would hope to control the globe from battle stations there. It means targeting of utterly commercial countries today, like China, but which are among the fastest growing big economies on Earth today, not because China is a threat to the United States, but it is going to be at least an alternative. It's going to be a separate source of power that we either adjust to or we repeat the disasters of the 20th century. And in a war with China, we will bankrupt ourselves, militarize the Chinese leadership, divide Japan hopelessly over a renewed war with China. And it is, like the Vietnam War, a war we will ultimately lose. But there are people in Washington who are actively encouraging a military intervention in China. Is, after all, it is President Bush who said that he would do anything to protect Taiwan with all means. This is simply open and explicit intervention in the last dregs of the Chinese Civil War of the 1940s, which was then politicized by us because of its anti-communist implications. I believe there's every bit of evidence that the last thing the Chinese want is a war with Taiwan, but that they're aware that they simply could not survive a declaration of independence by Taiwan on nationalistic grounds. They would be overthrown. Any regime in China would be overthrown by this sort of insult of having Taiwan severed off and become essentially a colony once again of Japan and the United States. That would be the way it would be seen in the mainland, and that therefore they have made it clear that they can't tolerate that. By far the most dangerous aspect of these people's ambitions, military ambitions, is the national security document that was signed in September 2002, first outlined by the president in June of 2002 in his speech at West Point, calling for preventive war, that when we identify a country that we believe is potentially hostile, and as we now know, often based on utterly spurious intelligence, we nonetheless reserve the right to invade it, overturn its government, and install essentially a puppet government of our own. So far, we don't have a very good record of that. That is, in the case of Afghanistan, it has descended back into the same place generating Islamic terrorists that it was before 2001. It is the world's largest producer of opium today. The warlords are back with a vengeance as our allies now. And similarly, whether or not we actually get a government of any sort, much less a democratic government, in Iraq by June 30th is, I think, one of the longest shots in betting history. As I say, I believe we're in a truly no-win situation, and we simply stay there until the American public demands a withdrawal, even with our tail between our legs. We can't stay and we can't leave, given what we've created.
And in addition to what we're doing there in Iraq and Afghanistan, I understand that we're also going full bore to secure bases of
Absolutely.
Other countries in that region.
Colin Powell refers to the new family of bases that we are building in what they've now claimed to be the arc of conflict. It is a swath of the world extending from about Colombia in the Andes in South America, across through North Africa, the Middle East, and ending in Southeast Asia in the Philippines and Indonesia. It is also, not coincidentally, the scene of the world's largest oil resources, which we are pursuing vigorously. And this is calling for bases in some of the most anti-democratic, not undemocratic, anti-democratic places on Earth. I mean, for example, the attempt to control Caspian Basin oil in the area of the former Soviet Union that is now states that became independent after its breakup in 1991. We have bases in Kyrgyzstan, in Uzbekistan. These places are ruled by ex-communist functionaries that make Kim Jong-il of North Korea look like a fairly nice guy, or at least simply just a movie buff. These people have all been entertained in the Oval Office. What we're talking about is Caspian Sea oil. In the base structure report of the Pentagon, they do not mention, for reasons that are not clear, but I think we could deduce them pretty easily, the monstrous base called Bonstil in southern Kosovo in the Balkans. The Army likes to say there are two places, man-made places on Earth, that you can see from outer space, the Great Wall of China and Camp Bonstil. It was built in 1999 by Kellogg Brown & Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton, the most expensive base we've built since the Vietnam War. Kellogg Brown & Root supplies all the services there now. They clean the latrines four times a day, very expensively. But what it's for, it's part of the military petroleum complex, that we have a plan to pipe oil out of the Caspian Sea in down to the Black Sea, transport it across the Black Sea, not going through the Dardanelles, where the size of ships is restricted because of the very narrow straits, across the Black Sea to Bulgaria, transporting it then by pipeline that has also been surveyed and designed by Kellogg Brown & Root of Houston, across the Balkans and emptying into the Adriatic and Albania. Camp Bonstil lies directly athwart this route and is there to protect it, ensure that it remains in our hands. This is worth remembering, that our troops in Kosovo are supposed to be there as a peacekeeping operation. Bill Clinton said that they'd be there for 6 months. The current president ran on a proposition they shouldn't be there at all, that he would like to see it done. Well, they're there, and they're there to stay. These bases are very, very permanent.
So again, returning to the big question, how do we as American citizens deal with the corporations like Kellogg Brown & Root?
We have to have a reinvigorated Congress, a Congress that is beyond vested interests. We need election laws that would make it an honest Congress. We probably need we've just gone through this insane system of Democratic primaries in which very small states like Iowa and New Hampshire dictate to California, Washington, New York, Massachusetts, Florida, who our leaders are going to be. This calls for I regard this as a constitutional amendment is needed in this area, much more importantly than over gay marriage, which strikes me as the business of people who want to have a gay marriage. I've certainly endorsed the idea and admire the Massachusetts Supreme Court for making that decision. It seems elementary justice. But it's in the political system where we're in trouble, where it's starting to really creak and come apart. Paul Kennedy, the historian at Yale who wrote the book a decade or so ago called The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, used to love to tell a story that as he traveled around the country talking, some American citizen would stand up and say, "Professor Kennedy, are you predicting the decline of the United States?" And he would say, "Well, no, not strictly. I simply would like to say to you, I cannot imagine the evidence for the opposite point of view. That is, what evidence would it take to say that the United States goes on forever? There's been the collapse of an awful lot of empires over the last century, and the United States has made almost the classic bungles to put us at risk. And that is my message in this book, is to try and both issue a warning and provide the evidence to see how far extended we actually are. I do not honestly know whether it's possible to make these reforms at this late date. We have crossed the Rubicon. We are, I wrote a piece comparing the Roman Republic and the American Republic, in which I warned about the possibility of a military populist leader, a figure like Julius Caesar or Octavian or something of this sort. 3 weeks after I published it, Wesley Clark entered the race. And I thought, oh my God, here's a four-star general entering the race. It's coming a lot faster than I thought. Now, he didn't get anywhere, but it's not at all clear to me that that Mr. Kerry is anything other than Bush Light, and that the pundits are saying you could defeat George Bush. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I strongly fear that it wouldn't matter whether one way or the other to the ultimate outcome. I mean, don't get me wrong, this is the year of the monkey, and I would vote for a monkey against the current administration. But I happen to have a Howard Dean bumper strip on my car only because I thought the Constitution was the issue, and he was the first to notice and seriously put his money where his mouth was, that the Constitution was the issue and that it's under threat.
Finally, you must have, since the whole point of the book is to raise the alarm, you must still foster some hope there that that the alarm will be heard and people will make the change.
Well, obviously I do. I mean, that is to say, no one predicted the extraordinary movement that began here in Seattle in November 1999 of a coalition of quite diverse people who had finally uncovered the fact that the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund were among the most fake anti-democratic institutions on Earth, beyond congressional supervision because they're formally international organizations, but actually totally dominated by the U.S. Treasury. I know two very wealthy Orange County, Newport Beach doctors who flew up here and demonstrated with the Vietnamese wearing turtle costumes. I mean, they're very serious environmentalists. That movement, which was just panned ruthlessly in our establishment press, the sort of Tom Friedman type apoplexy in the New York Times over what these students and others, unionists, physicians, professionals had represented, this movement then continued to spread around the world, attracted and gave inspiration to an awful lot of people who were feeling one or another grievance in the face of fake globalization being run from America. It then slowly moved into an anti-war movement with the rise of the War Party in the United States. 500,000 students demonstrating in Florence a year ago with the Prime Minister of Italy, Berlusconi, calling them Talibanized hordes. It's very much along with Tony Blair, the New York Times, the rest of them. This is, I think, a sign of optimism, a sign of the public, of a grassroots movement coming up and beginning to confront the powerful and manipulative and things of that sort. Whether we have enough time, whether it will continue to grow, whether it will gain solid ideological foundations, all of these are open questions. I'm inclined to be pessimistic on them, but if I'm wrong, you will forgive me. You're going to be so pleased I was wrong.
All right. Any final thoughts?
Simply, the subtitle of the book, The Sorrows of Empire, is important. Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. This is not just an anti-Bush book. It is an attempt, and in fact, one of the things I try to point out is the rather considerable continuity between the American imperial project throughout the 20th century, going back to the Spanish-American War. But what I am trying to lay out here is something that I don't think Americans realize, namely our flirtation, at the bare minimum, with imperialism has led inevitably to the rise of militarism, which is protected by massive governmental secrecy, and that is a cancer growing in our society.
We have just been talking with Chalmers Johnson. He is author of The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. Chalmers, thank you for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you. Great pleasure to be here. Very nice interview.